Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
Greg Lukianoff is one of the country's most prominent defenders of free speech. He's a First Amendment attorney who's built a reputation taking on high-profile cases that have challenged progressive efforts to restrict speech on campus, but also conservative attempts to use government power to limit expression. He's also been really candid about his own struggles with depression, which led him to work with cognitive behavioral therapy. And his experience informed his concern about how campus culture and emotional reasoning can affect the thinking of young people. Lukianoff's work with the social psychologist Jonathan Haidt also explored these issues. They co-authored the book The Coddling of the American Mind, where they examined the effects of safetyism and tribalism on college campuses. And they argued that trying to shield students from ideas and words they find uncomfortable can actually contribute to anxiety and can undermine resilience and open debate. Weeks after the murder of Charlie Kirk at Utah Valley University, Lukianoff was asked to speak on the campus. And he says he went because he wanted to be with the students, to find a way to reaffirm the principles of free expression he'd always believed in. Still, he said he was scared to go.
When I was invited to speak at UVU, I had mixed feelings about it. One, I felt kind of a duty to go speak there, but also some trepidation. Some amount of like, oh my god, someone got murdered there. And as best we can tell, for his speech. And I'm not as controversial as Charlie Kirk, but, you know, I'm hated by the left and the right for various things. So the idea that I might even have to think for a second about my physical safety was kind of new to me. Obviously, I wasn't so scared that I decided to, you know, cancel it. But certainly when I told my family that I was going to go speak at UVU, I got a lot of, you know, like, are you sure? Do you really want to do that? Because, you know, if we've reached the stage where political violence becomes more common, then yeah, a lot of people I know are more concerned. We are in a different space. I think we're in a crisis. I think we're inside of it right now. And the Charlie Kirk murder was part of it. And the fact that when you poll students, so many of them actually say violence can, at least in some cases, be acceptable in response to speech. But also the backlash, also the fact that Trump and sort of the right in the U.S. took such advantage of the murder to go after their political enemies in a way that I've also, you know, never seen. I was worried about the future of free speech my whole career. I started really worrying about it even in law school at a time when it felt very secure, you know, in the late 90s. But it's happened faster and harder both in the United States and globally than I could have expected. But I signed up to be a defender of freedom of speech. I've been willing to get death threats. I've been willing to, you know, lose friends every so often, which I hate, to be honest. I've been willing to, you know, be shouted at and all this kind of stuff. So my goal in life is to leave free speech safer than when I started it, you know? And so if I'm being asked to do something like go to the site of where someone was killed to talk about free speech, to try to make the argument about why free speech is the best cure for violence ever invented, that I felt a duty to do that. I felt like this is what my career has been about, and I don't want to, you know, shrink from that duty.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Greg Lukianoff is our guest today. As someone who has spent a career fighting for free expression, We wanted to know what he found when he came to Utah, what it told him about the atmosphere in the country right now. And it's interesting, aside from making his case for free speech, Lukianoff told us he also went to UVU to be with the students, to grieve with those who were still coming to terms with Charlie Kirk's murder.
You know, I talk about my experience being very close to a friend who was nearly killed. And I talked a little bit about it, I think, that day.
Yeah.
A friend when I was 15, I think, who was stabbed right in the chest and really, really looked like he was going to die. That is with me to this day, as you can tell. You know, like that's something that is an experience I will never forget. And having even just seen the video, as horrible as it was, of the shooting, I can't imagine, or unfortunately, I can't imagine the experience of actually being there. And I'm so sorry for anyone who has to go through something like that. So, yeah, I mean, no matter how they felt about Charlie, it was a human being, a father who was murdered, and right in front of them, too. And, of course, there's also that moment where there's a shooter.
Yeah.
You know, when you think it could be you. And of course, when I actually went to the site where he was shot, the thing that struck me so powerfully was when you watch the video, I don't know what this effect is, but you watch the video and the amphitheater looks giant somehow. Like it looks like this, he's speaking in this giant space. But you get there and it is so small and so intimate. And the idea that these young people who, you know, came in some cases just to argue with someone that they maybe disagreed with or maybe liked. And to see that so close to them, you know, my heart breaks to this day for those students.
I think it's interesting when you are grieving with them because actual violence happened. With your friend, that was actual violence. But there's this disconnect because people, some people on campuses, some people throughout the country, think that words also create a kind of violence. And making that distinction has been really important to you in your life.
Well, the speech violence distinction, I occasionally will get like the student who thinks they're being very clever making the argument that essentially it's a sort of social construct, that essentially it's just a decision we societally made to make a bright line distinction between the expression of opinion and the commission of physical violence. And I say, yeah, you could argue that. And to a degree, you'd be right in the sense that everything is, you know, intersubjective reality.
Yeah.
But it's one of the best inventions we ever came up with, because most of human history, we resolved conflicts of belief, direction, conflicts of all kinds with either actual violence or more often the threat of actual violence or coercion. So the decision to have democratic societies and societies like the United States, where your speech is supposed to be protected to the greatest, fullest extent of the law under the First Amendment, where we are basically making a peace treaty with ourselves to a degree to say, listen, violence is no longer okay. Violence is not the way we resolve things. We now resolve things through argument. But because it's about such deadly serious things, of course we can't say you can limit what you can argue. That's to limit your own agency as a member of a democratic society. That's to lobotomize your own brain, in a sense, if you think of the country as kind of like a giant body, you know, is to say like, oh, you're not allowed to talk about these following things. So I do think that when people do the rhetorical escalation to saying this person's hurtful or hateful words are violence, that is really very short-sighted. It sounds great in the moment. It feels good to be like, how dare you say that? That, sir, is violence that you just said that terrible argument. But when you see actual physical bloody violence in front of you and someone tries to argue that harsh words are just the same, it feels so profoundly wrong.
And you say when you blur the line between words and actual, you know, blows and violence, that you give, this is how you put it, you give fear power over public life.
Absolutely. I saw this in response to the Milo Yiannopoulos speech. This was back in 2017.
Yeah.
And he was on a tour. He was a gay conservative provocateur who liked to get the goat of the left. by, you know, doing these, you know, big performances where he would make fun of like everything on the left and every sacred cow. Something that honestly, in different ways, had been happening on campus for decades.
Right.
But, you know, Milo happened to be doing it at a time when this got a lot more attention, and partially because there was a lot more ferocious response as opposed to people simply not attending his talk or protesting outside. People were constantly trying to shut him down. And there was this big riot, there's really no other word for it, at Berkeley. It cost about $500,000 in damages with, you know, Molotov cocktails and things set on fire and people smashed and a couple folks sent to the hospital, you know. But that riot largely took place when they'd already succeeded in getting the speech canceled. And the victims of the actual violence were usually just bystanders, in some cases reporters who were trying to cover it. And in response to that, instead of, oh my God, what have we done? The response from the Daily Cal, the student newspaper, did a whole issue on the Milo riot. And they had five or six columns defending the violence and basically making the argument that his words were violence, so our violence was self-defense. And my point is, aren't you seeing that that is a downward spiral into violence inevitably? Because someone that you hit claiming their words as violence, they're going to be acting in self-defense as well. It seems to be throwing out one of the best tools for innovation and peace and understanding. Even if you don't have that understanding part, it's at least effective, you know, effective at peace. And we're creating, you know, this incentive almost to rhetorically exaggerate the harms of words that will lead to something far, far worse.
One of the things you talked to the audience here in Utah about is your own sense of your American identity, which you talked about being shaped by this kind of ethnic eclecticism, is how you described it, that you encountered in New York City. And you talked here about the kids that you encountered in your neighborhood who came from places where there was real political oppression. So they had a different point of view about the world. Say something about what you were getting at there.
Oh, sure. Yeah. And I always joke that, like, I feel like the most American kid or ever American, precisely because, you know, my parents were from two different countries. They met dancing at a UN party, right, at a UN club party in New York City. You know, my dad has a, you know, thick Russian accent. My mom has a British accent. I grew up in a neighborhood where all my crushes were on girls, you know, who were from different parts of the world. Like the coolest kid on my street was this kid from Peru. There was a bunch of kids on the street who were also from who were from Vietnam, and there were the kids, like the families who had to flee Vietnam right at the end of the Vietnam War.
Yeah,
there were kids from Korea. There were kids, you know, like, and within the United States, there were kids from Puerto Rico. Even the white kids, like some of the white kids, were actually from the American South, which I'll be damned if that wasn't a foreign country to me as well. And it felt cool at the time in a lot of ways, but it also was what you grew up with. So what you grew up with is kind of normal. But the common language we spoke to a degree was, you know, what countries our families came from, pop culture, but also the idea that, like, what we were fleeing, you know, like the, because in South America, a lot of those kids were leaving authoritarian governments. But the ones who were from Korea and from Vietnam and from China, they were fleeing totalitarianism. And of course, my dad was fleeing totalitarianism as well. And so we never, ever took free speech for granted. We thought that was the coolest freaking thing about America. That eclectic neighborhood where we had such deep respect for what was cool and different about America, it was something that I almost wish everyone could experience. Because I think sometimes, you know, like if fifth generation Americans or whatever, they take so much of what's different and special about the United States for granted. I kind of wish they could see it through immigrant eyes sometimes.
Well, it's interesting how you've talked about what the system of education was like for some of these people that you encountered who had, you know, they were coming from the people, as you've put it, who ran the education systems in those different places. This is how you put it. You said it kind of took on a religiosity. And the point wasn't, like, the education system point wasn't inquiry. It was reform.
It was reform. Yeah, certainly in, you know, communist countries and, you know, for that matter, authoritarian countries, you know, but particularly totalitarian countries, like the idea is that the state is going to teach you how to be a good person, even if it has to lie through its teeth to you about its history, about its failings, about everything, because there are useful lies that you should believe that will make you a better citizen. We don't give a damn what kind of person you are. We care about what kind of subject or citizen you are. And that's most of the rest of history. And this is something that I think is something that I do love about being a first generation American and having like a Russian dad. But this was true of everybody on my street that was either immigrant or an immigrant kid. They all had a deep appreciation for the deep history of where they came from, and they all knew it much better than Americans know their own history. So we were very aware of the fact that the most of the rest of human history is a story of a very small number of people in charge, a sort of intellectual class that tells you how you should think and how you should behave in very strict ways. Violence is okay if people aren't obedient. Americans have a hard time with this. That's most of history, that's the way your society runs.
There's one true doctrine.
There's one true doctrine, or maybe a couple acceptable ones. That's almost as good as it gets. Mm-hmm. So not everything's totalitarian, but everything to a degree like has this idea of, you know, centralized power, handful of people in charge, a limited window of acceptable opinions. Yeah. Some are a little bit more cosmopolitan than others, but certainly for the totalitarian, there's only one truth.
Greg Lukianoff. He's the president and CEO of the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression. His most recent book is The War on Words, 10 Arguments Against Free Speech and Why They Fail, co-authored with Nadine Strossen. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us Greg Lukianoff, one of the country's most prominent defenders of free speech. He's always insisted free speech can be an antidote to violence. But when he was asked to come to Utah Valley University just weeks after the murder of Charlie Kirk, he said he was scared to go. We're talking with him about why he went anyway and what he wanted to say to the students who were still processing that day, why he still believes speech is a way through fear, not a cause of it. Where did your personality come from? Like, you described yourself as a kind of radical nonconformist, you're kind of a contrarian. But where does that come from? I mean, I guess you could say it's your folks. But at some point, you started to build your life around what you've described as this discomfort in sports stadiums, being part of the crowd. So where do you think that comes from?
I got to say, it's got to be in the blood somewhere.
Yeah.
And I took some razzing about the whole and discomfort in sports stadiums from actually some people I genuinely love. But there's something about being in a crowd in unison that creeps me out at a profound level. I don't even particularly like concerts. There's something about like we're all as one and we're all cheering together and I want to enjoy it. I want to be part of that crowd at some level, but it gives me the willies. I have to figure this is the same thing that caused my family to flee the Soviets and to, you know, my dad to get kicked out of high school for opposing the Nazis. Like, I think that there's something deep in there that just feels like an outsider, but feels really uncomfortable being on the inside.
It's like a phenotype that you have or something. And I wondered, are there any downsides to the inclination, like personally, like, dude, you don't have to argue every point, Greg. Or can't you just make up your, you know, like I don't know. Or do you feel burdened by that in some weird personal way sometimes?
Well, I don't argue every point. I remember people saying that I should go to law school. Yeah. And I always took it as a little bit of an insult because I'm like, what do you mean?
Right.
And they're like, because you love to argue. And I'm like, no, you're misunderstanding me. Huh. I don't actually love to argue. I have very strong, you know, principles and beliefs on a lot of these things. Yeah. So like I feel passionately about a number of things. So I do argue, not because I love to. And getting to law school was actually pretty hard because people who would just argue for the fun of it, and I tended only to argue about stuff I cared about, you know? Like, so that was a mental shift I had to engage in. I will say, always feeling kind of like an outsider, even when I maybe wasn't, that could be lonely at times. Mm-hmm. And I do actually, and this is, okay, I didn't mean to bring this in such a sad direction, but there was one guy in law school who, I remember one time we were at this dive bar that we would take everybody to, like the only dive bar like anywhere near Palo Alto, you know, that was kind of our hidden gem. And we would love to go there and, you know, drink with what we considered to be more of like the regular people. And he told me one time after a couple of drinks, and he's like, Greg, you know, you are one of us. You're not an outsider. And it got me all choked up. And the reason why this is so incredibly sad is because that guy was kind of an outsider too. And he recently took his own life, actually, in the last 2 months.
I'm sorry. Well, while we're here, this is personal for you. I mean, you take this personally, and we don't need to work through what you've described as a very dark period in your own life. But I think just to sort of remind people, you've talked about this experience in 2007 when you were in this psychiatric facility in Philadelphia. And the reason I bring it up is not to sort of take you through it again necessarily, but it seems important in how you had, first of all, that you are affected by this stuff personally. Because it seems like part of what was going on, this deep sense of being in a depressed state, was driven by what you were seeing in the culture war, like the dissension that you were seeing. That seemed to be driving part of it. So that's interesting to me as I sort of think about how that affected you. But then the other part is, it seems like what you've done is you used that experience, that really dark experience, and the therapy that came from it, to really start to understand more deeply and dissect the sort of cultural inclinations that are going on in terms of the resistance to freedom. Is that a fair way to say?
No, it absolutely is. It absolutely is. And yeah, so I'll start with my 2007 breakdown.
Okay.
You know, I became president of FIRE in 2006. It was hard for all sorts of reasons, you know, some of them very much personality driven. But at the end of the 2 years, when FIRE was going to let me move back to New York, where I had a better like circle of friends and more psychological support and all this kind of stuff, I really started to sort of fall apart. And it was partially feeling guilty, you know, about the idea that they were giving me this great exception, you know, for me. Like, what do I think? I'm so special that I can get to, you know, move from the headquarters up to New York. But also, frankly, it was a big part of it was the culture war in a very personal way. The culture war stuff doesn't bother me so much in the abstract. I'm willing to defend people all over the political spectrum and you know, like, and the idea that I would defend speech I disagree with or even hate, I'm like, I take that for granted. It was more the personal part, you know, like I was in Buddhist circles and I was dating this cute girl and she hated the fact that I defended Republicans, and she, you know, we broke up because she didn't like the fact that I defended people on the right. Yeah. I also very nearly got in two separate fistfights at bars with right wingers because they didn't like the fact that some of the cases I defended on the left. And there was that sense of not true isolation, you know, of just I felt like I couldn't be too close with my staff because that would be inappropriate. Like, I just felt very, very isolated and just like I couldn't hack it. And so I got myself checked in as a danger to myself, because I was, and I was pretty sure I wasn't going to make it to the next year. But then I got back to New York and just as I had hoped, being around my friends and family and some surprising, you know, there was actually even an ex-girlfriend who had no business being so sweet to me and was incredibly, incredibly kind about it. And I started doing cognitive behavioral therapy.
Yeah.
And within, I mean, I didn't think I was going to make it to the next year. By the time the next year came around, I was, and I like, it's almost a weird word to say, I was happy because all of like the self-critical, angry, guilty, scared, you know, voices in my head didn't sound as convincing anymore. Because that's the whole practice of CBT is like those exaggerated voices you hear in your head about either you're being worthless or that you're doomed or all this kind of stuff. You get in the mental habit of talking back to them until they don't sound that true anymore. Mm. Once those habits really were ingrained in my head, it was one of the most free feelings I had in my entire life.
And I think it's so interesting that it seems like then you could kind of relate to what was going on with people who felt as irrational as you consider it. It seems like you could relate now to people on campuses or wherever else who felt like words were somehow violent. Like it seems like you could relate in a way and understand it in a way to help you sort of deal with it in a new way. And you wrote two books about all of this eventually. I mean, that it seems like it was a gift what you went through. I hate to put it that way, but it seems...
No. I think that's fair. I'm not a religious person, so yeah. You know, I don't think everything happens for a reason.
Yeah.
But I am a Viktor Frankl person, and that you can put reason into things.
Yep.
And I think I kind of felt before my breakdown that there was some kind of psychological upper limit to what I was capable of, or what I could survive, and that I wouldn't be able to ever touch that ceiling, you know. And then after it felt like that was just all gone. And in addition to that, I had these new tools for how to talk back to my brain and sort of tame it to some degree. You wouldn't even want to tame it entirely. Now, to be clear, I did empathize with a lot of these students, you know, going way back.
Mm-hmm.
But what I really started to recognize was, wow, it's like the adults are constantly telling people to engage in cognitive distortions. It's like in our compassion for them, we're basically saying, aren't you worried? Aren't you worried? Aren't you worried?
Yeah.
Don't you think it's going to be a catastrophe? Aren't you afraid that everyone hates you? Maybe everyone hates you, in fact. You know, like all of these messages that we were giving the young people, I was like, oh, my God. Like, if they were listening to you, they'd be so anxious and depressed.
Hmm.
But at the time, 2008, I felt like this was when I was learning all this stuff. What I was seeing on campus was mostly the adults out of compassion, basically being worried about all of these things, but kind of modeling this distorted mental behavior.
Hmm.
And it was only around 2013, 2014 that I started hearing students who seemed to actually believe in this stuff. So it very quickly occurred to me, since I'd been thinking about it for years, that if students come in and believe that words or speech that is offensive to them or offensive to someone else on campus will psychologically harm them permanently in a deep physiological way that can't actually be addressed. It could only be addressed by blocking that speech out.
Yeah.
You know, that of course, you know, gets some of my Buddhist inclinations up too, because it's kind of like, that's like telling people life isn't pain and then expecting them to be horrified every time normal pain in life actually happens, which is just a horrible disservice. But I quickly realized that if that's what they've now learned, that's going to be a disaster for freedom of speech, academic freedom on campus, because these students are going to believe that it's their moral duty to shut up speech that might harm the most vulnerable people on their campus. And that would also going to lead to a massive drop in mental health among the young people who believe it, because that's a disempowering experience that takes away your internalized locus of control, the idea that you have positive influences on your life.
Yeah.
And it arms you with these ideas that if you really believe them, they're going to make you miserable. So I pitched this to my new friend at the time, John Haidt,
mm-hmm.
and we started working on an article about it, which became an article titled something that a name that I still hate, Coddling of the American Mind. And then when we sold the book in 2018, I was telling everyone I knew, I'm like, no way in hell we're going to call this thing Coddling the American Mind, because I felt like it sounds insulting to the people I'm trying to help.
Yeah.
But we sold it under the title Disempowered, because basically what I felt like we were doing was we were whispering into the brains of all of these resilient, brilliant kids, you really can't handle this on your own. You should be more scared than you are. You are less competent than you believe. Have a nice day.
We don't have to go through all of the principles in the book, but I wondered if you wouldn't mind working through one of these core principles, these sort of cultural shifts that you write about, which is safetyism. Where, as you say in the book, emotional safety gets elevated to a sacred value. Just as a way of sort of describing how you, for people who don't know the book, work us through that idea, if you would.
Yeah, so safetyism, and it's a term that was suggested by our research assistant, Pamela Paretsky, but it was for a concept we were all trying to figure out a good name for, which was essentially the idea that it seemed like at one point in the early 2010s, if you could make an argument that something would increase physical safety or a mental sense of emotional safety by even, you know, 0.001%, then it was worth it. Mm. And there was nobody arguing back saying, okay, that's going overboard. That's actually treating it like it's a sacred value, as Haidt would like to point out. And that essentially it can't be traded for other things in life. Mm. And our point in that is that safetyism, like an excessive, and it's by definition, we define it as an excessive commitment to an unrealistic level of safety that can be very disempowering. And then you start getting really weird developments. And I'll take the example of trigger warnings, which I'm sure there are a lot of listeners who are like, no, those are nice and those are compassionate and those are good. And I say, I definitely think they're compassionate, at least in intention. But Haidt and I predicted when these really kind of started being more mainstream, that they'd existed in some circles since the 90s, but they're much more mainstreamed in 2013, 2014, 2015. For anything, you know, a warning that you would give, trigger warning, that you're about to read something that involves suicide, for example. Mm. And what Haidt and I, you know, said almost immediately was like, that's priming people to be anxious. That's kind of like playing the scary music around something and then being shocked that people are scared. Like, are you really thinking this through? There's now been like 12 studies of trigger warnings, maybe more, maybe less. But the, you know, certainly by the time we got to like the you know, study number 6 or 7, you know, I started losing count, that have tested whether or not they'd have any benefit. Every single one of them has found no benefit. No benefit to people with PTSD, no benefit to other students. And unfortunately, none of these studies have also studied the fact that, at least, you know, from every professor I've talked to, once you start implementing trigger warnings on certain topics, professors start avoiding those topics because they don't want the headache of essentially implying that their students are going to have a breakdown if they read this thing. And in addition, a number of those studies showed that people became more frightened of words, started to believe that people were more easily harmed by words, started to believe in safetyism, essentially. Like trigger warnings kind of promoted a safetyist view that people are inherently fragile. They can be easily and permanently damaged by words or ideas or images. And I remember, you know, when the original article came out, later we got more blowback from it. But when the initial response to it came out, when it was published in The Atlantic in the summer of 2015, I was really shocked at how positive the response to it was. And the single response to it that meant the most to me, just absolutely just blew me away, was a young woman who wrote and said, my brother committed suicide and by jumping off a building, I believe is what she said. And she was in a class, in high school, everyone knew this and everybody was kind of on, you know, eggshells around her about all sorts of things just to make sure she wasn't traumatized by it.
Yeah.
And she was in a class where nobody knew that about her. And they decided to watch a movie that included a character who committed suicide. There was no trigger warning. And she said, I felt like someone was saying, who didn't know me, but by being left alone and treated like a normal person, I felt like someone basically just said, you're okay. You can handle this. You're not a special, fragile thing. You can handle it. And it just made me so happy, because like this is one of the things that's so interesting about British culture, because my mom is ethnically Irish, but she grew up in Britain, so she had Irish blood, but she has British culture.
Yeah.
And sometimes people can see this as this kind of like harsh teasing among friends, you know, that they can do with each other when two friends really love each other, to be clear, and both men and women. And like my auntie Pauline would ease my mother Joanna and be like, oh, Joe, you know, like, and sometimes it could sound kind of like tough. And I was always kind of surprised that my mom's reaction to it was that when in a hard situation was essentially what Pauline was saying, listen, you can handle this, Joanna. I believe that you're strong. I believe that you're resilient, which is something that like a lot of people didn't quite get. Whereas in a lot of cases, the sort of more Russian habit of when things are miserable, just really, you know, going deeply into your sadness might not be quite as constructive.
That's Greg Lukianoff. He's president and CEO of the organization FIRE. That's the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression. We'll take another break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the First Amendment attorney Greg Lukianoff. Just weeks after the murder of Charlie Kirk at Utah Valley University, he was asked to speak on campus, and he confessed to being scared to go. The experience put his commitment to free speech to the test, but he came away reassured that open debate remains a powerful tool against hatred and intimidation. Every year, FIRE does these surveys about their attitudes toward speech. And I wanted to ask you what you're seeing in the latest rankings, because I think some of us were thinking there's a course correction possibly going on, that at the sort of the height of the what seemed like the really intense conversation about free speech and, you know, trigger warnings and conversations on campuses and other places, that was really playing out in, you know, 2020, 2021. And there's some question about whether or not it's faded since. And this year's results, you've talked about, they're the worst since you started asking students. So what do you make of that, and what are you seeing? What are you finding?
Well, student attitudes are a little bit of a lagging indicator of change.
Huh.
You know,
yeah.
Like what we're seeing now is that students were taught bad lessons about tolerance towards other people's speech years ago and when they were growing up. And by the time they're hitting campuses, they still believe, you know, like about a third of them think that violence can be acceptable in some at least rare cases in response to a speaker on campus. Something like 70%, I think, said that shout downs are okay.
Yeah.
Like preventing a speaker from speaking by shouting down. I don't mean just booing them. Or even blocking people from getting into talks are okay. So that scares me. And one of the things that is not... the right and left have come together to a degree on this in the worst possible way. And that it used to be kind of the harder left that was more okay with this kind of stuff. Whereas the sort of like further right students now are actually matching the students on their attitudes about violence and shout downs and that kind of stuff, which is awful. And on campus, when it comes to things like, and what this data is relatively new, like our Students Under Fire database, which is attempts to silence students, our Scholars Under Fire database, which is the same thing for scholars. This was probably, at least in terms of like total, you know, cases of on-campus censorship, the worst year we've ever seen. And it's the first time, and we've been keeping records, where it's coming directly from government intervention. you know, like, you should get this person who said something, you know, not nice about the murder of Charlie Kirk. You should, this person should be punished, expelled, fired, etc. Yeah. And of course, you know, I'm not sympathetic to people. I thought it was horrible that Charlie Kirk was died. Mm-hmm. But is there any question you can say something, you know, like, because I also always make the point myself that I just disagreed with a Charlie Kirk on any number of things. And some of the people who are being punished, by the way, weren't saying things much worse than what I've said. Mm-hmm. About Charlie Kirk. So we've seen this huge spike in cancel culture, as you might want to call it, from the right, you know, coming from the Trump administration or local governments or individual politicians. But here's the thing that makes it even worse is the fact that you haven't really seen, you have seen somewhat of a decrease on the threats from the campus left, but not as much as you would think. So we're kind of living in a worst of both worlds here. And the thing that's suffering the most is open discourse and, in many cases, professors and students themselves in a situation where we're apparently trying to, you know, fight fire with fire and then be surprised that everything gets burned down.
What difference did the murder of Charlie Kirk have in all of this? You called what happened here in Utah at UVU a rupture. What was the effect?
We don't know yet is the ultimate answer. But what we know in the short term is that student attitudes among moderates and conservative students have improved somewhat on their appreciation on whether or not they think violence or heavy-handed tactics to shut down speech is okay.
Yeah.
And that's a good development. The sad thing is on the left, it hasn't budged. And that's concerning. I look at people, you know, celebrating Luigi Mangione, and I'm like, I don't celebrate people who just, you know, shoot parents for, you know, because I don't like them. That scares me for the left. I think the use of this by the Trump administration and by other people, you know, to go against everyone from Jimmy Kimmel to individual employees, you know, is of historic significance already. I wrote in the New York Times about an ex-cop in Tennessee who was put in jail for 37 days because he sent around a meme in response to a request to go to a Charlie Kirk vigil. He sent around a picture of Trump and a real quote from Trump saying, "We need to get over it." And then referring to that, he made that comment in response to a shooting at a place called Perry High School in, I believe, Indiana. And the sheriff, who already hated this guy, decided that somehow that would be read as a threat to the students at Perry County High School in Tennessee. And therefore, this was reasonably understood to be a threat. So therefore, threw him in jail, set a $2 million bond, and he was there for 37 days. We just filed a lawsuit in favor, but you have to go back to the 1920s to find a case of speech that should be that clearly protected under the U.S. Constitution, resulting in that kind of jail time.
One of the things you have talked about is this idea of the American project being an ongoing thing. Not something that was settled, that you've written about it in this way. You said that free societies don't automatically stay free. They have to choose again and again to be free. And you describe it as this kind of libertarian wager. Can you take us through the concept of because it does seem like we're taking for granted the fact that these ideas about freedom of expression are just a settled thing, but it seems like you're really worried about that, actually.
I am. And here's where being an immigrant kid, you know, like has a downside and knowing your history. but in this case, at least it's valuable. America sometimes thinks that we're like there's this weird kind of like we're historically normal, that our country is just like every other country, and somehow we resemble, you know, in political systems, at least, like the rest of the world, you know, prior to and just prior to relatively historically recently. That's just not true. But that means that since, you know, people grew up here and their great-great-grandparents might have grown up here and they see the political system as being at least somewhat similar, they can fall into this idea that, we're always going to be a free country. We're always going to, have freedom of speech and our Bill of Rights and that kind of stuff. And my answer is absolutely not. Liberty, freedom of speech, rights, they're a decision. And if enough of your society stops agreeing with that compact that we've made with ourselves, with our fellow citizens, with our country, it doesn't last. So you have to, first, you have to want it, and you have to believe in it, and you have to defend it. And the thing that scares me the most is I don't think enough people right now want it.
Well, here's something that you may have taken some heart with, and that is that, one of the questions was, did the experience with Charlie Kirk's death change the way students tolerate free speech or worry about the possibilities of political violence and all of those kinds of things? And one of the things that you found was that Utah Valley University was one of the best schools in FIRE's rankings when it came to opposing violence.
Yeah.
You must have been pleased by all of that.
I will say one of the things that did genuinely, I came there kind of heartbroken for the students, but man, they impressed me so much. Like the entire environment at Utah Valley University was so moving because those students had been dealing with it. They've been dealing with it eyes open. And they were moving on and they were showing such bravery and resilience and wisdom, from the experience. And as far as something that kind of like reminded me of that sort of, wonderful sort of like almost youthful energy that can go side by side with a feeling of being free, I felt that there. And it reminded me that, freedom can endure as long as people remember, to some degree, that feeling like in their hearts, the idea that like, I'm my own person, I'm entitled to my own opinion. And I'm one citizen among many, and I hope they'll respect my rights and I'll respect theirs as well. There's something profound and beautiful about that, that I hope we can inspire a generation again. I'm gonna keep fighting for it. And I know everyone at FIRE is gonna keep fighting for it. And I think the students, at UVU are gonna keep fighting for it.
One of the things you do in your more recent book, The Canceling of the American Mind, is you talk about how you raise an anti-canceler. And it sort of gets back to what you were saying earlier about the fact that, look, young people on college campuses have their own agency. They're grown-ups. They're getting that way anyway. But in some ways, it's their kind of our fault. It's the actual grown-ups, their parents' fault in some level. So you write about how to raise an anti-canceler. We don't have to go through all of this. We don't have time. But one thing that I was struck by was the golden rule part.
Yeah.
Will you just say something about that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it is something that's interesting. Like I said, I'm not religious, but I do love studying religion.
Yeah.
And I do love studying, wisdom traditions and faiths and all that kind of stuff. And how often a rule very much like the golden rule is treat others as you would, have yourself treated. How many different ways it manifests. And, it is one of those things that to remember that. If you remember that idea of having, compassion for even those people you disagree with, and that they are people and to remember them and their humanity, it can get us so much further. And I think about actually how much golden rule type thinking is embedded in those sayings that we don't say nearly enough anymore in the United States. But like I grew up with, coming kind of full circle back to my childhood, it's a free country was very empowering to be like, hey, buddy, kind of like, you may not like it, but he's entitled to it. But also things like, everyone's entitled to their opinion, which is kind of saying the same thing, even the very beautiful and simple to each their own, yeah. I was a weird little kid and I needed that one, for sure. It's like, oh, Greg's a little weird. It's like to each his own, man. Even things like don't judge a book by its cover. These are all ways of saying, dude, check yourself. Put yourself in your place, show some humility and some open-mindedness, and try to see everybody with the same sort of compassion and curiosity that you hope they would see you.
Greg Lukianoff, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Greg Lukianoff, he's the president and CEO of FIRE, that's the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on YouTube at KUER 90.1. You can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.